Live from Burbank, California, the heart of America's non-existent heartland, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he tried to hang himself with a shoelace. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, need machines, pain sponges, the frightened. I welcome the frightened. Nice to be here. It is Thursday night. This is I have a sense of excitement and schadenfreude in a way that I don't usually get. The Supreme Court ruled today that President Bush has overstepped his authority in ordering military war crime trials for Gitmo Bay detainees, saying that that they are illegal under the U.S. law and under the Geneva Conventions. What a beautiful kick in the butt that is to the president, that he thought he had this court stacked. He thought he had it fixed. He thought he had it rigged. And they came out in the name of law against this dictator. But this dictator, this leader of the neocon death cult, George W. Bush, the president by coup d'etat. I don't usually talk like this, but this is one of those situations that I think really calls for that type of talk, has basically sworn to go around the court in a way, the way he wants to sort of go circumvent checks and balances and go to his stacked Congress and try to fix this, to go against the court's decision and get Congress to vote military tribunals through. This is the behavior of a dictator that still is only playing with the semblance of what this government is supposed to be. Now, all we can hope on some level is that Congress sees this the same way and behaves properly. I don't know if they will. I think that, you know, he is politicizing this by saying he's going to go to Congress and by saying things that this is for the safety of the country. He's basically saying that President Bush is basically saying that the American people need to know that the ruling, as I understand it, won't cause killers to be put on the street, that he's going to play this safety card. And the bottom line is, after seeing the movie I saw last night, and we're going to talk to the co-director in just a few minutes, The Road to Guantanamo, is that what the military has done and how they treated these guys and these detainees, and most of them, a lot of them initially, who some of them were kept over years, were not guilty of anything other than being Muslim and brown and being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And they were forced into captivity and tortured until many of them gave confessions that were warrantless other than the fact that they were in so much pain and wanted the pain to stop. And the United States of American military needed numbers, needed to show that we have terrorists. This thing makes the country look bad, and I don't know what it means for the future of Gitmo, because I know there is a movement to get it closed and start processing these detainees through the American justice system, if there are even charges to be had. But I'll tell you, man, that movie was disturbing, and I can't wait to talk to this guy in a few minutes, because where we are right now, the movie, The Road to Guantanamo, is about three guys who were picked up in a sweep in Afghanistan with the Taliban and parts of the Northern Alliance, you know, shortly after 9/11. And what's sad now is that Afghanistan is completely out of control. The Taliban is back. It is controlling a good part of the country right now. There's completely no control of the warlords who are operating with the opium trade. It's just a mess of warlords, and the Taliban has been resurrected. And the reason a lot of this is happening is because the military did not finish the job there, which was the justified war. If there was a justified war in response to 9/11, it was certainly in Afghanistan. And the rush for the neocon death cult to get to Iraq was so profound, obviously you all know this, that they left this place a wreck. And the bottom line is the Taliban is able to recruit because the anger against the Allied forces is so extreme. The desperation on an economic level is so extreme. And if you don't want to work for the drug warlords and a guy from the Taliban comes up to your door and he's holding the head of your cousin saying, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't join up with us, you're going to join up with them. Karzai is stuck between a rock and a hard place because he can't stop the corruption. But I guess the point I'm making is, despite everything that's gone on with Guantanamo Bay and the reason it was set up and these war criminals, these people who were captured on a battlefield, is that war was never finished. And because of that war not being finished, there's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of opiates being flooded around the world. And believe me, ex-CIA operatives are getting kickbacks from this man. And there's part of me that thinks they didn't want to finish. They did this for a reason. They left this place in primitive chaos for a reason. Well, now the who they were fighting initially is back, you know, and there's nothing to stop them. And there's nothing to stop the opium business. And then I guess that's where I'm going to leave that. We got a great show. We got an entertaining show.
Well, that was happy.
What do you want? I mean, you know, we're going into an interview with the guy that made The Road to Guantanamo. We got plenty of comedy coming up later in the show. We got Hard and Firm. We got my buddy Jack Boulware on the phone. John Landis, the director of the Blues Brothers, is going to be on the phone with us. And there will be fun in the show. Hard and Firm. And then there's something about the oil. You know, look, some days it's just like this, Jim. There'll be plenty of funny.
I understand.
There'll be plenty of funny. You've got your funny, too, coming up, a little something you do. We'll be back with Matt Whitecross.
Now he's hot, pregnant, and nude. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. I didn't want you to tell everybody that. You know, there are so few movies that even take on the other side of the equation of what is happening in this war, the war on Iraq, the war on terror, all these wars. I've only seen one film previous to seeing The Road to Guantanamo that even attempted to take on the human side of the Muslim victim. And that was a film called The War Within, which is a drama, obviously, but it was a fiction based on renditioning. And it was a horrendous window into a very human element that we don't even identify in this culture. That is the Muslim person, you know, it's caught in the middle of this assault on jihadists. By us. I shouldn't call it an assault. There is a war going on, but The Road to Guantanamo is a very powerful film about four young guys who live in England. They go to their familial home in Pakistan on September 10, 2001, where one is to be married. And then bang, 9/11 happens. After 9/11, they are inspired by an imam in Pakistan to go to Afghanistan to help in the aid process after bombing had begun. And through a series of events, they are swept up with the Taliban and eventually end up detained at Guantanamo Bay, at Guantanamo Prison. The director of The Road to Guantanamo is with us on the phone from England. Thank you for joining us, Matt Whitecross.
Thank you very much.
Your film is a documentary reenactment of true events shared with you by the victims of those events, three of which are in the film, one of whom died. And it all seemed very authentic in terms of the reenactment. Where did you shoot this film?
Well, we shot it in a variety of different places. We have interviews that we shot in Britain, and obviously when the actors who are playing the Sipton Three set off, then it's all set in England. But then we tried to set it in the places they actually visited. So we went over to Pakistan, we went over to the village where the marriage was supposed to take place. But when we went over the borders of Afghanistan, there's obviously still only kind of certain areas that are safe, you know, for Westerners. And I think, you know, we had these three actors who'd never been in a film before. They found it was very difficult to ask them to go to Afghanistan in the first place, to ask that of them and their parents.
Yeah.
We had to make sure everything was secure. It was kind of slightly different to making a kind of investigative documentary in the traditional sense.
Right.
So we then shot all the other kind of Afghan sections over in Iran, and Guantanamo Bay was built in on an army base in Iran as well.
It was pretty fascinating because, like I was saying in the intro, like, you've got these three guys who are real guys who are in the film talking about their experience. Then you have the film itself, which is a reenactment, but a very dramatic reenactment. That's a movie within a movie almost. It's not like [S2] Right. [S1] A television reenactment. And I'll be honest with you, I could never imagine just how bad the treatment of these detainees was. I can never imagine, you know, what it would be like for somebody who was truly guiltless to be in this situation. And then that these guys actually all seem, in some respect, okay.
Well, it's true. It's very, very... What surprised me the first time I met them was they are very, very down to earth, and they really play down the effect their experiences had on them, which is incredible, and it's actually very endearing. I think we spoke to other detainees, and they're exactly as you would expect. They're very traumatized. They are very withdrawn people. There are a lot of people who have got a huge amount of anger about what happened to them. And I don't know whether it's just because of their nature or whether they managed to come to terms with it because there were three of them there or what it is. Or maybe they were younger than the other people and they weren't separated from children and so on. But they really don't seem to have any rancor towards the United States. They're very normal people still. Having said that, you know, you talk to them, when you get to know them the better and you kind of talk to them in more depth, they're reluctant to talk about it in public. But, they, you know, there's no doubt they have been extremely traumatized by events, but they really don't want to kind of display that in public, I think.
It's very interesting to me that I think one of the reasons is that they were able to stick to their story because they were not guilty of anything, and they were educated, and they were clear as to what was going on and how they were being treated, and they were able to see the tricks of U.S. and British intelligence that were playing on them to force a confession in order for them to get their numbers up in terms of how many terrorists they may have caught. And I think that's probably what saved them, is their friendship and their intelligence.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, unfortunately, you have to kind of say up to a point. They went over there. When they were over in Afghanistan, when they got picked up by the Americans, initially they assumed, well, because these were American soldiers, they were going to be treated well, they were going to be sent home, they were going to be given, you know, kind of justice and due process. It didn't happen. So initially they were very shocked and so on, and they were beaten up and tortured. But I think, inevitably, some of the tactics that were used, they used to play Eminem to try and frighten, the Taliban and so on, which obviously if you're either an Afghan farmer or you're a Taliban or even a member of Al-Qaeda, say, you won't have experienced necessarily that kind of music. But these guys grew up on Eminem. They grew up on Jay-Z and Puff Daddy. So for them, it was just like, it was completely bizarre. They could sit there and nod along to it interrogations. Or they'd be asked bizarre questions like, if you were in Tipton, which is the equivalent of saying, if you're in New Jersey, where would you pick up a surface-to-air missile? At the same time, you know, eventually, of course, it did affect them. You know, they confessed to all the things that were put to them on paper. They confessed to having met Osama bin Laden. They confessed to having plotted 9/11. Because eventually, you know, no matter what the truth is, no matter even if you're innocent, if you're tortured enough, if you're beaten enough, if you're treated badly enough, you will, of course, confess to anything. That's what we tried to show in the film.
It's just amazing to me. And also today, I don't know if you read that the Supreme Court here in the U.S. has said that the use of military tribunals and the denial of due process and rights is a transgression of international law. They ruled against the president here on this, and I don't know what implications that's going to have for the future of Gitmo, but they've been talking about closing it down. And maybe this window that you provide people in terms of how it makes the Americans look and just the process of intimidation, humiliation, and torture that went on there will really raise awareness of it. I mean, we all sort of know about it, but very few of us can picture it.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, this information is out there. It's never really been presented
right.
In this form, but it is out there. But, you know, at the end of the day, no American has ever voted for Guantanamo Bay. No American has ever voted for the war in Iraq. People have voted for Bush, and this happens to be one of his policies, you know. And I think it's been what I found very informative is meeting people in New York when I went over there for the Tribeca Film Festival. And the amount of people who approached us and were saying, look, I just want you to know it was not done in my name. It was done in my name, but I had nothing to do with it. You know, I really want people to know that I support certain policies of this administration. I'm proud to be American. I'm proud of, you know, what America represents to the rest of the world. But I did not vote for Guantanamo Bay.
It's interesting that, you know, just to talk about the film specifically a little bit, is that the way it really plays in the film is you got these four guys. They're, you know, 19, 20 years old. They're not, depicted. I don't know if they are as you know, completely non-secular people, religious fanatics in any way. They're obviously
right.
Practicing Muslims. One has been found a wife in Pakistan, which is normal to the tradition that he comes from. And they go there to be part of this wedding, and I guess, you know, 9/11 happens, and they find themselves in a mosque in Afghanistan where the imam is basically saying, look, you know, our brothers need help, they're being bombed, and they could use some aid service up there, and they decide, well, hell, we've never been there, it might be kind of fun, they got big pieces of naan there, and almost has that spirit of like, hey, we're young, let's go to Europe thing.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's the main thing. Although, you know, they did go over with a convoy of people helping, going over there to provide aid for, Afghans who had been bombed. I think the fact is, although they kind of say, well, you know, that was partly the reason, I think the main reason was the sense of adventure.
Right, right.
And hopefully that comes across in the film, you know, because I think you spend any kind of time with them, and every time we've spent time, you know, kind of filming over here or when we were in Pakistan, they disappear for a couple of days, you know, we'll be with them, they'll suddenly change plans. The wedding plans changed kind of three times while we were out there, so in the end we had to shoot it in a completely different way. We had to delay going to Afghanistan and so on, because that's just the way they live their lives. You know, when they went over there, they were kind of 18, 19 years old, and we've had exactly the same experiences with the actors, because the actors are from the same, we chose them, most of them are non-professional, and they come from the same background. They're exactly the same kinds of people, and it's very, very difficult to organize them. When they felt like disappearing off to, you know, to go and meet people or, you know, kind of explore Afghanistan when we were out there filming, it was very difficult to keep the actors under control. They'd disappear for a night and turn up the next day. And this is in Kabul, you know, supposedly one of the most dangerous places on the planet if you're unlucky.
Right. It was very interesting also is that, you know, when you see Afghanistan, when you, and now that you tell me that you actually filmed there, and I've seen footage of Afghanistan, is that, you know, we are talking about what would be considered a fairly primitive culture, and it looks that way, and there's a frenetic sense of, you know, like the marketplaces and the streets and the amount of activity. It's very different than anything Americans are really accustomed to, but when you sort of connect these guys to their heritage, and you realize that, you know, these people are just part of a culture that we don't really understand, but, you know, in terms of what they like and what they're into and who they are in the world, they're no different than American kids. And that was really the menacing and frightening thing, that somebody guiltless, given any given this set of circumstances, could be put away for 3 years and tortured and beaten until they admit to something that they were not guilty of and held prisoner by the United States of America is horrifying.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I've got a personal connection to this because the Egyptian three consider themselves British. They were born and bred, you know, in Britain. They love U.S. culture, U.K. culture. You know, they're just like, you know, most of my mates back in school when I was growing up. But when they were captured by Americans and then also by the English, they were not considered to be British because they had brown skin, because they had, by the end of their time there, they had beards, they'd become religious. And they were not afforded the same kinds of protection that, you know, that other whites, you know, middle-class males would have had if they'd been caught in the same situation.
Right.
And I know that my parents were political prisoners in Argentina during the 70s.
Wow.
And my dad had exactly the same feeling of kind of complete immunity from any kind of, you know, repercussions of his being out there or being involved in anything dangerous. Because at the end of the day, he was like, well, I'm British, I'll be all right. And hilariously, the Tipton Three thought the same thing, and they were not considered British by their own government, despite the fact that they were.
Well, thank you so much for making the movie, Matt Whitecross. The Road to Guantanamo is a must-see. It's here in L.A., it's in New York, and it will be in Washington, D.C. and across the country, and hopefully available on DVD soon. You take care of yourself.
Thank you very much.
You bet. We will be back with, what are you mad about, Jim?
Nothing.
Really? You sure?
Wow.
Do you want to spin the wheel of anger?
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's give it a spin. And it lands on
public art.
Wow. All right, we'll be back with that in a second.
He no longer has a blank check for abuse, Mark Maron.
All right, Jim, we're back. We've spun the wheel. It's landed on public art for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into this. Jim Earl's Wheel of Anger.
Mark,
mm-hmm.
You know there are a lot of know-nothing boobs who don't appreciate the modern art we put up in our public places in all our cities. I know this is true because I'm one of those know-nothing boobs. When did bright-colored plastic cows, pigs, and rabbits get to be art? I don't like most of the stuff passing for art nowadays, and it's everywhere. Seattle, Chicago, San Diego, Bloomington, Illinois, for goodness sakes. Cincinnati? The good people looking at this example were better looking than what they were looking at. Kansas City, Washington, D.C. makes as much sense as the politicians there. Plainville, Texas, another culture center. Memphis, Tennessee. This was done to honor Martin Luther King. It's called I've Been to the Mountain.
Jim, excuse me. I don't see anything.
Can I finish my thought, Mark?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'm an admirer of everything Martin Luther King stood for, but I don't think he would have stood for this. In New York, Lincoln Center has the best opera.
Stood for what? I can't see anything, Jim. What are you talking about?
It's just a lump of metal cubes in front of a building, Mark.
Bill, what's going on here? What's he talking about?
I see it, man. It's a big pile of cubes in front of a building with colors.
Oh, damn it, Bill. Bill's high again.
In New York, Lincoln Center has the best opera, the best ballet, the best symphony orchestra. Is this Mickey Mouse sculpture out front really in an artistic league with what goes on inside?
What sculpture?
This is named Two Indeterminate Minds. Well, I may not understand art, but I do understand the English language. And that's pretentious nonsense.
Jim, this is radio. People can't see what the hell you're talking about.
Hey, Mark, I think I know what's happening.
Yeah, what is it, Andy?
I've heard this before. It's Andy Rooney. Jim's doing last week's Andy Rooney rant. I swear, it's word for word.
Oh, my God, Jim, is this true?
Does every open space have to be filled in? Is this really better looking than nothing would be? I don't think so.
Jim!
Okay, so what? Read the prose, man. Listen to the poetry. Every week I go through the same hell. Trying to tap into his muse. That magical turn of phrase. The inspiration. And every week, nothing! I had no other choice.
But you just lifted it word for word, Jim. That's stealing.
Don't judge me, Mark. I swear to God, I'll kill you.
Ooh, okay.
Close your eyes, Mark. Listen to the words. Well, I may not understand art, but I do understand the English language, and that's pretentious nonsense. Oh,
you already did that one.
I'll do it again and again and again. I gotta wrap my head around this bastard genius, or I swear to God, we're all doomed. I know it,
Jim. Can I just
shut up? What? What the hell do you want? Huh? What in the hell do you want? Don't get in my space, man. You're standing on the edge of a great abyss, fella.
I'm just saying I think this is a real positive step for the show, and that's all, really, okay? No big thing, all right? Now just go ahead and finish it up, Jim. We're all very anxious to hear the big ending.
Whoever did this suffers either from a functional disorder of the mind or he's putting us on. I don't like it, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure you'll correct me. Tick, 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 tick. I'm Ed Bradley, and we'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Min... Oh, whoops, forget those last two sentences. I'm Jim Earle, and you've just taken a ride on my wheel of regret.
Okay, good deal. That was good, Jim. Great.
Yeah, a lot of stuff's been going on.
Yeah,
I'm looking for a new apartment.
You don't got to tell me.
And you know how that is.
Yeah. Are you really looking for a new apartment?
Yeah, we're looking for another apartment. Yeah.
What? You just moved into this one.
I know, but we found another place that's for the same price. It's a lot larger, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're under a lot of stress.
Yeah, a lot of stress, but it's okay, man.
The cat's not feeling well?
No, cat's very sick. Melvin's sick. You gotta have to give him, pills.
All right, okay. Well, I understand.
You know, it's okay. You don't have to talk about it anymore. It's all right.
I'm concerned. And
well, we have to give him like two pills.
Yeah.
Like every day, and and then give him a saline solution injected into his neck like every other day. Yeah, you know, he's getting dehydrated. So.
Yeah, yeah. That, you know, it's
you don't have to talk about it if you don't want it, man. It's all right, man. I don't want to bum you out or
I'm reaching
anybody
out
else
here.
Out here.
I'm reaching out here.
I know it's not very appropriate to, you know, what else is what we're talking about today. What are we talking about?
Well, we just talked to a guy about Guantanamo Bay. We've covered a lot of serious stuff. There's nothing wrong with personalizing things a little bit.
I wonder if they have cats, any of those guys.
I'm sure they did have cats. I'm sure they did. My cats are doing fine.
Yeah.
Nah, that's the wrong thing to say. I'm sorry.
That's all right, man. I'm sure.
No. I do want another one. I think you ought to get a kitten. I think it's the right idea.
Mm.
We talked about it, and you said that Heather might not like it, but I think you should just say, hey, look, here's a kitten.
Melvin seems to get he's getting friskier now, though. I think it's helping.
Jimmy's 16.
16? Cats live to be 20.
Okay, all right.
20.
Yeah,
okay. What?
Enough said. No, you're right.
You can be
optimistic.
Did I bring this? What am I doing?
No, you're not. There's no buzzkill here. We're just talking about feelings, and this is the time to do it.
Is Bruce Cherry coming on?
Bruce Cherry is actually here in town.
Oh, man.
As he always is.
You used to have cats.
Did Bruce have cats?
Yeah, yeah, lots of cats.
You and Bruce know each other from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He used to be my supplier. He used to be a real funny guy out in at the Holy City Zoo who would come tell jokes.
Yeah.
Give us all comic jokes.
Yeah, jokes. Big, nice, stinky jokes.
We would pay him for some stinky jokes.
Kind jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bruce is sweating. It's so funny. He comes in. Usually you see him in New York. He's covered with a gloss of sweat. And here is dry heat. And what? He's like in shorts and not a drop on him until now when he started talking
about it. He's got to walk all that half block of what, from his apartment to the office.
I know. And when you're Bruce Cherry, that's not nothing.
Bruce came all the way out from his house to get this abuse?
No, Bruce is a lovely man. You know, I have to cop to something. I have to be more gracious and express more gratitude to the people around me, okay? And I just want to thank you, Jim, and Charlie, and Bill, and Andy, and Bruce for being there and for doing this show with me and for doing such a great job on what we have to deal.
God, thanks a lot. Yeah. What's going to happen?
I have no idea.
What do you do? What is this?
I really don't know what's going to happen. But that's besides the point. What happened to me last night that made me realize this is that I did this show for this guy for nothing. This What's My Line show. Had a good time. He's a very meticulous guy. He runs it. He runs it just like the 50s. They have to be polite. We got some laughs. And, you know, I overstepped my bounds once. I made fun of a guest. I made a joke. And that's a big no-no. But whatever. Yet, I did it for nothing. I dressed up. I put 2 days of my life into it. I worked hard. I honored the form, and we did a good show. And this morning, I had this problem with somebody else the other day. I expected a thank you note. And so, of course, at noon, I'm like, I don't see nothing yet. So I write him. I'm like, I just want to say that for somebody who's so meticulous, blah, 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 that maybe, you know, you might want to put a thank you note into your repertoire of doing that, blah, blah, blah. And I just want to say I don't plan on doing the show again because I'm sure I broke the rules somehow. But thank you for having me on. And then, of course, a half hour later, the letter from him comes I was just waiting for the pictures that we took last night from the show to download. And usually I send those out with a thank you note. So now now I'm going to have to do the, sorry, thanks again, email. But because my reaction was so strong and so stupid and self-centered, I realized that perhaps I have to express a little more gratitude in my life. There's a little spirituality for you.
Well,
that's all.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
And by the way, the show's over.
I accept your gahunga. Get freaking high.
I'm kidding. I won't know that till this afternoon. But I will know this afternoon.
can I just bus boy? You know, can I be a bus boy?
You want to come to Dantana's with me in the suits at 6?
Yeah, Dantana. What isn't that where Quincy used to go for after he solved the case? Dantana's?
Probably. Yeah, it's been around a long time. Usually, yeah. You can go there and actually see Ron Jeremy. Right now, we have a surprise guest who has just popped into our studio. Oh, my God. He claims he's David Nevin's grandson. That's weird. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Hey, Mark. It's actually John Zach, the NSA guy who used to tap your phone.
Oh, my God, really? I've never seen you in person. So what happened? So you quit the NSA? You came to Hollywood, huh?
Yeah, I developed a stand-up act. Balloon animals, a little mime, then closed with a serious rendition of Rocket Man.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't hire me at the Comedy Store.
Wow, that's bad. I'm surprised, actually. I'm sorry to hear that.
They like the balloon animals in Riverside. It's artistic, and people get something they can take home.
Sure, I can see that.
Then I drive all the way to West Hollywood for an open mic, and Pauly Shore, whom I admire above all men...
I see.
Pauly Shore says, "You're a hack, buddy."
Wow, and that's surprising that he could say that. But I am, again, sorry to hear that, man.
I mean, these people just don't get it, Mark.
Yeah,
they don't.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I sound like one of your stupid phone calls.
All right, look. There's no reason to lash out, John.
It's just... I used to listen to you ranting and raving on the phone when I tapped your calls, and I was always thinking, boy, if Mark Maron can get that far when he's a complete whack job, imagine what a guy could do if he had his head together.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know what a guy can do if he has his head together? Not get his phone calls returned from Dave Rath. That's what he can get.
Wow. Well, look, John, you've only been here a week. You can't expect instant results.
Dave Rath won't return my phone call.
Okay, calls. All right. Okay, take it easy. All right, just
take it. You
could
do something for me. You could. You just won't.
No. There's not much I can do for anybody, really, John. I mean, I've got maybe 12 people listening to this show.
Yeah, that's what they all say. Everybody acts real nice when they meet you, and everybody is going to be part of your project, and everybody's going to make you part of their project, and then nothing happens. Jesus Christ, at least Al-Qaeda has some follow-through.
I know, okay, I know, I get it. It's really frustrating, and you're just going to have to ride it out, buddy.
Oh, I don't have to do anything, Mark, because what I can do is go back to the NSA and start exploring a new security risk.
What? I mean, what do you mean?
I mean, after the way I've been treated, a lot of people in show business pose a much bigger threat to security than I thought.
Hmm.
Maybe they're not returning my calls because they're only communicating through their immediate Taliban contacts.
Look, John, I may not be the best person to say this, but bitterness might not serve you in the long run, you know?
I'm going to break Pauly Shore. I'm going to break him. And Aaron Spelling.
John, Aaron Spelling is dead.
Yes, he is. I got to go, Mark.
Wow. That was weird and awkward, and Bruce Cherry's coming in, so more of that.
I like that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah? Well, maybe you guys can do an act together, the two of you.
Maybe. Sounds like a good idea.
Talk to you in a second.
Now his tomb revealed ancient woven flowers. Mark Maron.
Whoa! Wait a minute. There's a disturbance outside the studio. Hey, it's Bruce Cherry. What brings you to L.A., Bruce? Is Cantor's Deli running a two-for-one pastrami deal?
Save the wisecracks, Maron. I came out here because I'm pissed. I ought to give you a knuckle sandwich.
Hey, this is not the time to make a threat like that. That time would have been, a knuckle sandwich threat. That would have been 1934, Grandpa.
Don't make fun of my anachronistic speech patterns. What are you, a wiseacre?
Okay, calm down. Before I have you 86, what's the beef?
Look, I found out what you've been doing with the bits I've been recording for you in New York.
Yeah.
You didn't think I'd listen to the show, did you?
Well, statistically, I was on pretty safe ground. Nobody listens to the show, Bruce.
You are playing me for a chump, Maron. You recorded our intimate conversations before and after we recorded the bits. Then you edited them to make me into a laughingstock.
Bruce! We played your bits just the way you recorded them. I promise, okay? And the bottom line is nobody was laughing.
Don't toy with me. Okay. I have proof. Mm-hmm. This is a conversation we had last month. It was diabolically altered to give a misleading impression. Play the tape, Bill.
Hey, Bruce, have you heard this? The New England Journal of Medicine is reporting that severe erectile dysfunction affects a man's voice. It seems if a guy goes long enough without getting an erection, his voice starts to speed up.
You seem to be speaking very stiltedly, Mark, but that doesn't make sense to me. His voice speeds up? That's absurd.
How the hell would that happen? Not getting a stiffy doesn't have anything to do with your voice. That can't be in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Well, I hear it's true. Oh, unless the guy is also incontinent. Then, get this, his voice starts to slow down.
What?
His voice slows down if he craps himself? That can't be right.
Look, Bruce, that was probably a technical malfunction.
Don't toy with me, Maron. Here's another example. This is our conversation the way it really happened, just after I recorded a bit. Tape, Bill?
Thanks for recording that, Bruce.
Hey, it's what I do.
I hear it's been hot and humid in New York.
Oh, man. Mark, the other day I walked through Greenwich Village, I ended up covered in sweat.
Really? Hey, what's another term for sailors?
Seamen. Why do you ask?
No reason. I bet you don't miss having a car. We pay a lot for that stuff oil is refined into.
You mean gas? Absolutely. It's out of control. Hey, I have to go. I'm cutting a bit for another show.
Yeah. Hey, what do you like on your hamburgers?
Cheese. Look, I really have to go. And now, here's that same conversation as broadcast after heavy editing. Bill?
Hey, let's talk to Bruce Cherry. Bruce, I hear you've been performing cabaret in full drag queen costume.
Hey, it's what I do.
And New York audiences are loving it.
Mark, the other day I walked through Greenwich Village. I ended up covered in semen. Why do you ask?
I'm just happy for you. I heard you were having problems with uncontrollable flatulence.
You mean gas? Absolutely. It's out of control. Hey, I have to go.
Well, that's obvious.
I'm cutting cheese. Look, I really have to go.
Yeah, take care of that. Bruce Cherry, everybody. Look, Bruce, that was not me. I'm going to track down whoever is responsible and fire them. Please accept my personal apologies.
Yeah, what about this thing we're doing now? This is pre-recorded.
Look, you have my word. This will air just as we recorded it.
Well, okay. But it better not happen again.
It won't. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I'm cutting cheese. I'm cutting cheese. I'm cutting cheese.
Bruce Cherry, everybody.
I'm cutting cheese. Is that the stupidest thing you've ever heard?
It's great to see you, man.
I've outdone myself.
You have outdone yourself. So now, how long are you in town for?
I'm here till Monday morning, Mark, so I'll be appearing on your show every day until then.
Really? You coming in tomorrow, too?
No, I don't have the time.
Oh, man. You set me up, and then you knock me down.
Is there a show tomorrow?
Sure there is.
Okay.
What day is tomorrow? It's Friday, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you know? What are you saying? What do you mean, is there a show tomorrow?
I'm not an emissary. I don't know nothing.
You were in New York. What's going on?
I'm at the Nexus of Power.
Yeah, you are. How's that feel? Why don't you tell the people that are curious as to what's going on at Air America, what's going on at Air America?
I don't know anything about what's going on at Air America. That's why I'm still at Air America.
So by the time this airs, we'll have gone to the Friars at Beverly Hills.
That's right, which I've never been to in Los Angeles.
Did you talk to Jim about his cat? You guys go back. Say something nice.
Jim, I'm sure the cat will be fine.
You're going to the Friars?
You want to go too?
I thought you were having a big meeting tonight.
Yeah, that's at 6. Yeah.
Then you're going to the Friars? You're going to laugh it off at the Friars with
he's got a meeting. He's got a
performance. Captain Trips here
it's
for
show business.
I am a professional, Jim. I'm a professional. I have literally. Let me be honest with you about my life in show business. I've cried literally like before, like 5 minutes, Mr. Maron. Here, 5 minutes, Mr. Maron. I don't know if I can do it. I don't want to go on stage, Mr. Maron. Showtime. Hey, everybody, what's going on?
Hey, man, I believe that 100%.
Captain Trips.
Captain Trips.
There was intimations earlier that I was some sort of narcotics dealer.
Hey, why don't you and Bill Kolar have a third eye kiss? Why don't you guys go connect head chakras?
And a feet narcotics dealer at that.
A feet narcotics dealer. I've never...
harsh words coming from a man who's crossed his legs like... Marlene Dietrich. Oops.
Yeah. You can say that because we're taping. You know, this whole thing is going to be like time travel. Yeah. Yeah, so you guys are... That's good that you have this friendship thing going.
I can't say Marlene Dietrich.
It's interesting that you're not Jewish because you do look like an elderly Jewish woman.
Oh, man,
Where did this come from?
Nothing?
Man.
That gets nothing?
Oh, my God.
You're going to the Friars with him?
What it got was shock, hurt, and pain. I can't believe.
I don't know how to insult. I throw a little barb like you guys were doing, and the response I get is like, why would you hurt me like that?
We're hothouse flowers.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
I'll see you at the Friars.
Oh, it will have fun.
Yeah, well, I will have seen you at the Friars.
Ladies get in free.
Yeah. I love you, man, and I appreciate everything you're doing, and thank you for doing that stuff for our show.
Don't try to hug me.
No, I'm gonna. Be back in a second.
Captain Trips. Nobody violated his laptop. Mark Maron.
Why do I keep it? It's Mark. It's Mike, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. That's
it. People call me Mark.
Do they do?
They do.
Because of Furman. So they think Mark Furman from the OJ.
Is that why I wrote it down like that?
Everyone does.
That's hilarious. That is so weird.
I answer to Mark.
You're a horrible man.
Why did you do that?
Yeah, all right, let me do an intro proper. Chris Hardwick and Mike Furman.
That's right.
Who?
Oh, no. Mike.
Mark Furman?
It's Mike, right?
Yeah.
All right. You're not screwing with me, are you?
No.
Chris, is he screwing with me?
He is not. It is absolutely Mike.
Chris and Mike met in college in 1994, and the music chemistry between them was magic, people. But they saw no future in it, and they went their separate ways. Now, 10 or so years later, they are back together as Hard and Firm and taking the country by storm, my friends.
That's right.
Their debut album, Horses and Grasses, with songs on it about things like the carbon cycle, Pie, Rodeohead, a bluegrass medley of Radiohead songs. Just inspired. Genius. Hard and Firm is heading straight to the top of the pops, Jim. And they've stopped by here on their way. Welcome, fellas.
Thank you.
Nice so It's nice to see you, man, and I appreciate you coming down. Chris has been here before.
It's a fun show. I love this show, and I love being on this show.
It's good times. You've never been here. Where have you been?
I've just been around.
You had Jewish holidays to contend with, I think, was the last problem that we had. Yeah. So.
Yeah, you went to Seattle for Passover.
Yep. Seattle for Passover. You're one of four Jewish families up there.
That's right. We all got together.
I grew up in New Mexico as a Jew, and I know what that feeling is.
I'm actually not even Jewish, actually. It was from my girlfriend's family.
Oh, so you're just...
I was taking notes.
Yeah.
I was just observing.
So you're trying to... Oh, boy, the conversations they must have had after you left. It's like, I know he's nice, but it's not right. Did you get that?
They were very, very, very inclusive.
That's how we play it.
So if they want to fit it in Seattle, they got to start breeding outside the pack a little bit.
That's right.
Just spreading the genes wide.
You know, Jews figured out a way around that. You just dress like the other people. You understand? You just wear the Madras shorts. You know what I mean? Put on the Izod. We can pass. So where were you guys like in this interim? Because I read the bio and you guys knew each other in college, and then you just you remained friends. You didn't talk to each other. Or you just how'd that work?
Well, I moved off for a little while and went to Europe for a little bit and just kind of traveled around. And Chris was doing TV.
I know Chris was on the MTV with the McCarthy girl.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I came back into town. And I actually didn't know if I was going to come back to LA or not. But then I just came down here because Chris had a spot in his place. So I moved back down here just for a little bit. And then we just started. I started doing visual effects. And then you were doing stand up. And I started coming up at the end of his set and doing some music, just like it used to be.
That's weird, because I remember when he started doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
So you came back, you went to Europe to find yourself, and how'd that go?
I was drunk.
Oh, okay. So you're drunk, and then he came back, and you're like, dude, can I sleep on your couch? Because I'm about to kill myself.
Yeah.
And you move in with him.
Before temporarily stopping in San Luis Obispo, your hometown, and working at a spice factory.
That's right.
You worked at a spice. Now, that's interesting. Hold on. Probing interview topic.
That's right.
Spice factory. What was that all about?
It was all right. It was good. It was a company called The Spice Hunter, which makes fine products. They're all very healthy and good for you. And really, it was cool. It's kind of a weird place for me to work. I don't have a sense of smell. So of all places, like, spices don't do anything for me.
Hold on. Check that off. Not a Jew, no sense of smell.
That's right.
Okay.
That was where the Lord punched him in the face for not being Jewish.
That's right.
And then he lost his sense of smell.
But, you know, there are benefits in not having a sense of smell in some situations that I'm not going to go into, per se.
Right.
But let's just say that there are benefits.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
Except that you don't know when you smell.
Yeah, but I don't also I don't care when I don't smell or when I smell.
Rebel.
So let's see.
All right, so Hard and Firm are here, and they're going to sing songs. That's what we're doing, Jim. You don't mind, right?
No, I hope they're spicy.
Yeah, they're going to be spicy.
Oh,
but you
man.
Know what? I hope if they smell, he's not going to be able to know it. Wow, bad joke city. Let's go. Let's do it.
Well, there's nothing Zeppelin-like, Jim, don't have to feel...
Thank goodness, because you would feel my wrath.
He's going to get a start. Is there anything Beatles-y about it? Because that'll just give him a boner.
Well, there are harmonies. Does that
There you go. See?
Uh-huh. Hey, what song are we going to hear?
We'll do American Dinosaur. Well, this is a song about... being from the South, as in Tennessee. I guess I sort of feel like we sanctify everything American in the South. And so we felt that there was a group of Americans that had gone largely unsung for their contribution to this great land.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. It's kind of like a... We don't have a lot of songs that have, like, a cause behind it, but this is one of those ones that, like... that, you know, like, the country's not just built on their land. It's really, like, built on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of, you know, like, no one's really paid them any kind of due or respect. So,
right.
You know, maybe, like, a movie will come out.
But they're even vilified in film, so that doesn't count.
Yeah,
so
right.
this is our song for the Native Americans.
That's right.
And it's called American Dinosaurs.
This is a song about patriotism. You can stand up if you want to. Glide on, mighty pterodactyl, on the winds of American pride. Step up to serve your country hundreds of years after you die. Well, they say that you were greenish, but I reckon that ain't true. If you trod upon the heartland, you must have been red, white, and blue. Your head so high, you're gonna bite the sky. American dinosaurs, a cry of freedom echoes in your roars. In caves and riverbeds, in soil where you bled, our nation's finest resource. Come on, everybody! I guess Noah had a reason for keeping you off the ark. Cause he knew you'd burrow in the earth and fuel American cars. And I think about your sacrifice as I power up my rig. Chosen lizards of this land, you're just so goddamn big.
So fight on, faithful Allosaurus, at the gates of the Alamo. While Diplodocus makes angels in the pure Montana snow. Tyrannosaurs visit Graceland and over Raptors egg DC. If the Azores play swim a blackjack in Nevada's desert sea.
A carbon date with destiny. American dinosaurs standing firm beside us in our wars. With your ample dino crack, a crapping glory on Iraq. Take back what is rightfully. American dinosaurs, mesoheroic petrol s'mores, over hills and on the plains. God bless your tiny brains. We the people are your dinosaurs. USA, God bless America.
Dinos sing.
Oh,
that was a good last one.
That's good, man.
I think something unique happened here. Was that a good last one?
It was
that
a good last one. My dinosaur. That was a good last dinosaur.
My dinosaur cry can be a little shaky sometimes.
That's great,
now,
man.
There is no scientific evidence that dinosaurs produced oil. That is not the case. But
yeah.
So when we do that song in the South, sometimes the irony is lost a little bit, and people are like, damn, give them their due. You know, they don't really.
Where do you guys go and perform? I don't know if we're going to have time for a second one, unless we do it right away.
No, that's okay. We can just talk.
Yeah,
we could talk, yeah. So when you go out on the road, where do you do it? Do you do comedy clubs? And
yeah.
We
go all over.
Yeah, we're starting a college tour in the
now
fall.
I would think that would go well. I mean, the weird thing is you got pipes, you sound good, the harmonies are solid. I mean, it's weird when you have relatively funny songs that are touching and funny, that when you sing it so nicely, I'm sure there are some girls who are just like, oh, this thing's so nice.
Actually, the perfect example of what really happens is we were playing in a bar once, and we were doing American Dinosaurs, and this hammered chick jumped up on stage while I was doing the song and whispered in my ear, why are you singing about this? So like that sort of encapsulated the reaction that we get a lot of the time.
Yeah. So it was the opposite of what it's saying, is that they hear how pretty it sounds, and they're like, why aren't you doing something pretty? Is that what that is? That
I,
how
I
you
think
read
it was
that?
Just, well, because the song has a slideshow that goes along with it that has, you know.
Oh, so like, you baffled.
Yeah, it's like a triceratops in front of the American flag, very sort of reverent, and they
just don't know what to do. Like they don't catch that necessarily. It's subtle or it's ironic. They're just like, you're trying something, aren't
you? Yeah,
they
just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. They just didn't. Yeah. So
chicks love that.
Yeah. They sure do. They love to be confused. If there's anything, they love to be confused.
I have not had that experience.
No, dude, they do.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll look into it. So when does that tour start? You can go to hardandfirm.com, right?
Yes.
But it's PH.
Yep, I was going to say.
Hard and PH firm.
That's right.
PHIRM.
And you can get the CDs there.
Yep.
And tour information.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts when?
We start in September. We start we're doing blocks of dates all over the place. We just kind of land in one spot and then drive around in a perimeter of about 100 miles and do colleges.
With a loudspeaker on the top of the car.
That's right. You guys singing?
Just old-timey.
Yeah.
Vote for Mayor Goldie Wilson.
That's right.
Well, it's good seeing you guys. I'm glad you came. Sorry we couldn't have another segment, but we kind of ran
okay.
a little tight.
That's all right. Please.
And you want to strum us out with something?
Sure.
All right. That'll work. We'll be back with Jack Boulware in just a minute. Stay with us.
And now, is this infected? Mark Maron.
It is. It is. Jack Boulware. BOULWARE.com is my friend Jack's website. Our guest has been a close friend of mine for years. He was the publisher of the now-defunct seminal freak show Out There magazine, The Nose. He spent time with Satan. He's hung with the inventor of the windowpane delivery system for LSD. He's chased wild pigs through the hills of Northern California, and he pursued and caught the elusive wahoo fish off the coast of New Orleans. Jack Boulware has traveled the far reaches of the world, chasing down the most marginal travel stories available. His work has appeared in Playboy, New York Times Magazine, Wired, Maxim, and Salon.com. He's here now. Thanks for coming, Jack. I got to do the intro properly.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, I like to build up to it. So,
oh,
Jack...
Sweet. It goes downhill immediately following that intro.
No. Just because you haven't traveled to exotic lands does not make any never mind as to whether or not we can do this. We'll find things to talk about. Like, I want to know when you're going to come down here with that new Gibson SG of yours so we can jam in my garage.
Well, I've had a little L.A. moment of myself up here in San Francisco.
Uh-oh.
So I've got my L.A. fill for the moment.
What happened?
I met this screenwriter and this film director. They came up here to research this movie they're working on about J.T. Leroy, the literary hoax.
Right, who you wrote a big piece on.
And they are picking my brain because I wrote the story in Salon about it.
So I'm not
used to this.
Right.
Know? I'm not used to, like, you know, young people in their 20s and early 30s, you know, going out to have drinks at dinner and just, okay, let's have a bottle of champagne. Okay, should we have some port wine? Yeah, let's have some port wine. Hey, anybody want some tequila? Let's get a round of tequila here. Hey, how about, here, take the credit card. You guys want red wine? Good. Yeah, a bottle of red wine, too. I mean, just nuts. You know,
yeah, just like young...
Entourage, the television show.
Right, like with no respect for any of the food, no respect for what kind of wine. Just like, oh, yeah, oysters, meat, bring meat. Pick up, you know what, bring a whole plate of steaks.
Yeah, it was like dessert. How about this chocolate thing and the cheese things? Do you guys like cheese? Okay, good, you know.
Yeah.
Totally. Just, you know, let's keep moving. We weren't, like, you know, talking about, you know, profound things that we needed to, you know. But here in San Francisco, people dawdle too much on their food, and it was kind of refreshing to see people who could care less.
Now, you know what you should look at that as? That's what we call a free meal here in Los Angeles.
Well, it was free meal here, too.
Yeah, you should always take advantage of any time where you've got film people who are or management types who are willing to take you out on their dime. They love to spend money, man.
You know, it was spending money like, you know, I don't know. It's just I don't know. I just stand back and just watch it. It was sort of like a new animal at work for
me. Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 They're going places. So now it's.
I know. I understand that. You know, that happens all the time in Los Angeles, but here in San Francisco, that is a freak show.
And people were gathering. Look, there they are. They're those L.A. types.
Look at them go. Look at them spend.
Yeah. So let's talk about your significant other, Christie's, producing a play out there by Irvin Welsh, huh?
This is the world premiere. Yeah, this is actually really cool. It's a world premiere of a new play by Irvin Welsh, who wrote Trainspotting. He wrote this play with his in San Francisco on email with his buddy who lives in England, who's a screenwriter, Dean Cavanaugh. And this is the world premiere of it. It's based on the rumor that there was a suicide on the set of the movie The Wizard of Oz, and one of the Munchkins got depressed and hung himself from a tree on the set. That's been a long-standing Hollywood rumor. These two guys took that and ran with it and wrote this play of four Munchkins trapped in a hotel room and getting beat up and abused by the big people. And the set is fantastic. It's very oversized, so... These are normal-sized actors, but they look, you know, within 10 minutes, you go, they're midgets. They look just like midgets, you know. And they drink, and they swear, and they smoke opium. There's anal rape. It's very, you know, lighthearted.
How much better would that have been if they really used midgets or little people?
You know, it was a big point of contention. When they were putting it together, they're like, well, will this get the midgets mad, you know? Because the midgets got all mad when only one midget was cast in the new Willy Wonka remake.
I tell you, the midgets are mad right now just because we're saying midget so much.
I know. It's dwarf, not midget.
It's not dwarf. It's little person, I think.
Little person, yeah. Oh, no, but nobody's protested.
Okay.
They were waiting for that because this is San Francisco. It's very PC. You can't walk down the street without, you know, stepping on someone's flyer. And there was no, like, little people outcry whatsoever.
So there hasn't been a lot of that since Randy Newman's album that I know of.
Yeah, he really put them in their place, didn't he?
The short people album. All right, so you went down to Susie Bright, who I tried to get on the show, won't get on the show, the pro-porn feminist. I'm a big fan of hers. Somehow or another, you managed to go to a party with her and her lesbian buddies in Santa Cruz. What was that about?
she invited me down there. I took, I haven't been to Santa Cruz in a while. You know, Santa Cruz is a very odd little town on the coast.
Yeah, it's full of witches, vampires, and hippies.
Exactly, COVID, and a lot of surfers who party harder than any other surfing community in the United States. They just go for it. They don't care. They drink, they smoke, they're like fools.
Yeah.
Right? They're good surfers. So I go down there, and it's like 06 was the day, Gen 6.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really know that I was walking into this, like, demonic-themed, you know, Satan party, you know.
Uh-huh.
And there's devil music playing, you know, Arthur Brown, I Am the God of Hell's Fire, blasting out, you know. And it got to the point where we're all sitting around a bonfire at the end of the night, and this was very Santa Cruz. Everyone had to stand up and, talk for a moment. And I watched middle-aged lesbians guzzle from a bottle of tequila
and
say something profound about whatever it is, and then just, you know, slowly take off their panties underneath their skirt and toss them into the bonfire.
Wow.
I've seen a lot of weird stuff, but I've never seen that before.
I wonder if that explains any of the global things that happened the day or two after. We'll have to look into it. Jack, we got to go. We're running out of time.
The moon cycle. Yeah, exactly. Thanks.
I'll call you later, man.
All right.
Take it easy. Jack Bulware, jackbulware.com. Burning panties.
And now, cops are looking for him in a park. Mark Maron.
Thank God I'm here then. Hey, folks, I'm excited about this. Most people know John Landis for his films Animal House, Trading Places, The Blues Brothers, and American Werewolf in London. He directed those, folks, if you didn't know that. He's directed music videos, commercials. This guy just keeps moving and working. He works a lot. He just released a DVD in the Masters of Horror series called The Dear Woman, and at the moment he is overseeing an immense undertaking at Universal in Orlando, the theme park there. The project is being labeled a Cinesphere Spectacular. I have no idea what that means. On the phone with us...
I'm going to make stuff up.
Oh, good. Great. That'd be great. On the phone with us now to explain is John Landis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
It's nice to talk.
First of all, I want to clarify one thing. I am a consultant. I'm not directing the show. This show is being directed by a very talented guy named Tom Venucci.
Uh-huh.
I'm the consultant on the film portion of it.
Oh, so that is like, that's a sweet gig. You just get to sit there and go, yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Man, I wish. But in fact, this is it's a huge spectacular
that
ends the evening. Have you ever been to Universal Studios Orlando?
Have not.
Well, it's quite a place because as opposed to Universal Studios LA, which is kind of a theme park stuck onto a tour, you know,
onto
a studio.
Right.
This is in fact was purpose built. It was built. It's a huge resort and it's built as an amusement park and a theme park, and the theme is the movies. And they're, ride the movies, and they have all these rides and spectacular things. And at the end of the day, starting this Saturday is the premiere, there will be this thing. It's a spectacular show called Cinesphere 360. It's complicated to explain because there's the lagoon is this big body of water.
I read the explanation, John Landis, and I couldn't understand it.
Well, there you go. Just wait till you see the show.
It's got to be so big, it's so amazing that you can't explain it.
There you go. So you have to show up. It's a trick. That's how they get you.
Let's try to explain it.
Excuse me.
All right.
I'm sorry. What?
No, that's great radio.
I started laughing.
It's all right. We can actually cut it out. We're not going out live.
Oh, good.
So I know there's huge spheres involved.
There are four giant spheres. They're about 60 feet tall. They're made of Kevlar.
Uh-huh.
And they're spaced throughout the lagoon, and it involves a new revolutionary projection system.
Yeah.
It's British. I've never seen anything like it. The images are projected from the inside and wrap around the sphere, but they are the centerpiece of what is, in fact, a fireworks, laser beam, laser mapping. I mean, there's all these pyrotechnics, all this stuff going on.
All right, so we're in a lagoon. There's four spheres with movies around them.
There's on them, I should say. They're projected. They surround on the ball.
Okay, all right.
And the movie is what I was involved with. It's a montage. It's a selection of clips from over 100 films to evoke an emotional response. And it's accompanied by this incredible sound design and pyro. Oh my God, it's such a deal.
When's it going to be done? But
I was just involved in the selection of the clips because it's a history of the movies. It's done very interesting. What they're going for is an emotional response.
Right, right, right.
And what I've discovered, you know, well, it's, you know this too, is that what we all share here in North America, in this great country of ours, the movies are really our common mythology.
Yes, that's good. Yeah.
And
that's true.
What I've found making this thing is that you want to get the iconic moment.
Yeah.
The shot or the scene that evokes a response.
Like when Al Pacino kisses Fredo on the mouth and you know he's going to die.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
Exactly. Unfortunately, that's a Paramount picture.
Oh, damn.
But you know what? You're absolutely right. And what's interesting is that Universal Studios is one of the oldest studios, so I'm going from silence all the way up to pictures released recently. And so, you know, people are saying, who's in your show? And I get to say, John Wayne and Marlena Dietrich and Jennifer Aniston and Jim Carrey and Lon Chaney Jr. and Lon Chaney Sr.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're doing is actually much more impressive and respectful than using computers to have all those people dancing together. I find that to be some sort of weird techno-necrophilia that makes me uncomfortable.
Well, I got to tell you, when Fred Astaire's widow did that, have him dancing with the vacuum cleaner for money.
Yeah.
That upset me, too.
Yeah. So now, okay, so you got 100 films in here. Now, when you go...
There are over 100 films, but moments. Just moments.
Right. Right. So you're going over them. You're John Landis. You love movies. You make big movies. You're a guy, and you're watching these movies. What made you go like, oh, my God, I forgot about that. That's amazing. Or what made you say, I've never seen this before?
Well, I looked at tons of movies. We looked at well over 1,000 films. What's interesting, and some of them fast forward, some of them not.
Yeah,
but
sure.
What's interesting is that it, how can I explain it? The argument that I would have with, you know, the suits here is I would have people and they would say, oh, nobody cares. Nobody knows who Cary Grant is. Nobody knows who Audrey Hepburn is. And I'm going, what are you talking about?
What? And what are they, like 20 of these suits?
Well, in fact, you realize that I would say the average age of the people watching this is probably under 20.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they want the most recent films, which is fine, because some of them, I mean, like, for instance, 40-Year-Old Virgin, I was happy to put a clip in there. I like that picture.
Funny.
And, but some of them, I just said, no, I'm sorry.
Right, but I mean, but you would think that at least the horror genre or even silent comedies, I mean, we can't build the whole culture around kids, because then there's nothing for me to do.
Well, you know what? You in something like this, when you're doing a public spectacle, it is literally appealing to the masses.
Yeah.
So what you have to do, I mean, what I find happens a lot, unfortunately, is they go for what they call a demographic, and that's basically patronizing. You know?
It's patronizing, and also it's like you shouldn't always honor what the masses want, because you know if you're clever and you're creative, you can make them want what you want them to want.
Boy, I wish you ran a studio.
Well, what are you doing? When you come back, call me up. I'll try to...
Well, I'm available. I got a show in August. Other than that, I'm available.
Well, it's not...
You know what I'm doing, actually, that's great fun?
What?
That I just started shooting Monday. Shot 2 days, and I'll be shooting it over the next 8 months.
Yeah.
I'm doing a feature-length documentary on Don Rickles.
Oh, that's great. He's great.
It is great. He's doing a show at the Stardust. Well, he performs at the Stardust often. And I don't know if you know this, but they're about to blow that place up.
Really?
And that is the last of the original casino.
They're going to implode it? They're going to do one of those?
Demolish it,
They're going to demolish the Stardust?
Yep. And that's really the last Vegas showroom, you know, of the old-fashioned Prima Con.
So are you waiting for that to end your documentary?
Probably, but in fact, you know, he brought the house down. Ha ha ha. But what I've discovered about Don, have you ever seen Don perform?
I love Don Rickles. I don't believe I've seen him live. But
well, that's the interesting thing, because Don is a type of entertainer that he's one of the last. I mean, he's out on the road performing, and he does a show. I mean, there's a 25-piece band.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he works, and it's a show. And it's not like other shows, because, for instance, most stand-ups come out, stand there, and talk.
Yeah.
Don sings and dances and runs around and tells no jokes.
Is that because of the time? Because I know I've listened recordings of him from the 60s, and he always sang. There always seemed to be an orchestra and a big nightclub act.
He's done essentially the variations on the same act since the 50s. And what's amazing is about half of it is, you know, repeated material, but yeah. Half of it every night is brand new.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. And John Landis, I got to, you know, and shift gears here because I want to ask you a couple questions about the other movie, The Dear Woman. I love Don Rickles, and I can't wait for that to happen.
Oh, well, Dear Woman, you can get on DVD. It just came out yesterday, I think.
All right. Well, okay. I want to talk about that. But what I want to ask is I had a conversation the other day with somebody about film comedies right now, about the Ben Stiller, Judd Apatow, Vince Vaughn matrix of comedy, about the guys who are in control of doing comedies in a genre that you sort of established in some respects. Now, my question to you is, it seems to me when I watched Animal House, when I watched Trading Places, that you were able to maintain the integrity of the story and of the characters without going so far over the top that it distracted from the narrative. And I have a problem with this. And am I being crazy, or do you find that...
No, you're responding to... It's not just comedy. You're responding to a problem that we're all dealing with, which is that in the new corporate Hollywood... And it's not just, I would love to, but I can't just blame the conglomerates, but
yeah.
the business has changed in a way where you used to be able to make, it's true in television, by the way, and radio, and publishing, all the media, mm-hmm. which is you used to be able to take something and build it by word of mouth. Now, if you don't hit, you're gone. So it's about marketing the film, and when you hire a Jim Carrey or a Vince Vaughn or a Tom Cruise or whatever, you have built-in marketing, and it's a safe bet. All these decisions by studio executives are essentially based on fear, you know.
Right.
It costs so much money to market a film. That's what people don't understand. Making films are expensive, but far more expensive is marketing them now.
But somehow or another, they have convinced the public, and we were talking about the masses a minute ago, to, if the public walks away from a film, you know, despite what the story may be about or despite what the narrative is supposed to do in terms of characters, and say, that one part where, you know, his hair caught on fire and snot came out of his nose was so funny. If they walk away from that thinking that that was worth their $12 or whatever, then the studios think they've succeeded with that film.
Well, first of all, it's not that what is true and has always been true is it's called the motion picture industry. It's even called theater. It's called show business.
Yeah, I know.
It's never been called, you know, the art.
But I don't think I'm talking about art. I think I'm just talking about.
But no, my point is that all the people who put up money to make movies care about is making money.
Yeah, I know.
So the definition, here's something that's, because I don't disagree with you, but I want you to see it in perspective. In the 50s, 40s, 20s, 30s, 70s, there are two things. What defines a good movie?
Yeah.
Well, in business terms, made money.
Yeah.
Animal House, brilliant. You know.
Thank God for that.
What defines a good movie? It makes a lot of money. Well, the truth is there are a lot of movies that make a lot of money that stink.
Yeah.
But in industry eyes, those are good movies. There are a lot of very good movies that people don't go see.
Yeah.
So you have to understand there's several yardsticks. One is a purely mercenary capitalist yardstick, which is, did it make money?
Right.
And these are hard-nosed decisions. I mean, you want to hear something very sad, I think. You know, I look at myself. I was very lucky in retrospect. Very, very lucky to become a filmmaker in the Hollywood system in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Because, the studios were in a state of collapse at that time.
Right.
And yet, I could tell you, when I my first studio picture was Animal House, that was Lou Wasserman's company.
Yeah.
MCA? Paramount was Charlie Bluthorn's company.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers was Steve Ross's company.
Yeah.
Arthur Krim was United Artists. Lou Grade was ITC. I mean... we had these moguls, and it was their company.
Yeah.
And they were in the film business, and they would take risk.
They had to, because they'd lost touch with what the youth market wanted, and you guys were young, and you were hitting it.
Well, truthfully, you're exactly right. What happened was there was a time starting with Easy Rider, and it was a good 20-year run, when the men running the studio said, you know, we don't know, we're out of touch, and a tremendous amount of respect was given the screenplay and the director.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the great time, I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, but look at some films, Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The Godfather. You know that you there's no not one studio that would make Chinatown now.
It's pathetic. It's pathetic. And
it's just, it's evolution. And, you know, look at television. It's not different. In television, for instance,
yeah,
you used to be able to.
Oh, yeah. Is that your phone?
Yeah, that is my phone.
All right, well, we got
to listen to that live on television. Well, let me talk to my lawyer. Wait a minute. Joel, I have to call you right back. You want to be on the radio?
Yeah, I could use a lawyer. Could I?
Okay, I will call you right back.
Joel Klein.
Bye.
Did you just witness that? We're in show business right now. So
that was my attorney calling, here come the men with the cuffs, and I'll be talking to you later.
The reality is,
I had this brilliant point, now it's completely gone.
Well, that's all right, because we've had a great conversation.
Wait a minute, that's going to make me nuts. What was it?
The point was that television is sort of the same.
Oh, no, thank you. Yeah. Television is similar, because now, do you know a movie, take a series like Seinfeld or A Friend.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those were very unsuccessful their first two seasons.
Yes.
But the network executives, Brandon Tartikoff in one case, said, you know, I like this show. I'm going to keep it on.
Yeah.
And they found their audience, and they became powerhouses.
Right.
Now, they put, you know, they produce six shows. They put it one on one night. If it doesn't deliver an audience, you're gone. You're history.
It's pathetic because, it really puts the talent in a compromised position. But we got to stop, John. We got to stop.
Okay.
It was great talking to you. I feel like we were just getting started. So can we, some other time, you'll come back on the show maybe when you're back in town?
Sure. I'm going to Europe Sunday. I'm in Florida now.
All
and
right.
I'll be back in September.
All right, John Landis, great talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Wow. That was great. We could talk for a while. Stay with us. Fun show.
Now he's conveniently located near a laundry. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. John Landis, man.
Oh.
John Landis, I felt like I could have talked to him for like a half hour. John Landis.
Well, there's always a next time.
The Blues Brothers. I don't care what anyone says. I mean, that was an important movie in my childhood.
No, it's a great movie.
He's probably on the phone with his lawyer, Joel, right now.
Joel.
I'll call you right back. And now they're talking big business, millions of dollars. Tomorrow, folks, I want to make sure I get all this in. A guy named Joel Rubin, journalist for the LA Times, is going to talk about the teachers' unions. The deal that was struck between the mayor and the teachers unions here in California. This is a state issue, but it is, what we talked about with Jonathan Alter the other night. We'll try to get Joel to give us both sides. He's a journalist. He's not going to pick sides. So maybe I can learn a little bit about this issue because it is an issue in some states. And someone on the blog brought up that it might be something, that has been talked about in terms of getting rid of the, Department of Education, in the federal government. To move it exclusively to the states. So I'm doing my homework. Also, we've got Vic Garbarini. The bands, if you want to get involved on the blog, we're going to talk about tomorrow, are Mother, Wolf Mother, the Raconteurs, and Arctic what? Arctic what?
Monkeys.
Arctic Monkeys. So if you want to pipe in tonight, pipe in. We've also got Eddie Pepitone on the street. Peter Horton, owner of an electric car, one-time member of the 30-something cast, I believe, wasn't he? Mike Henry and his brother Patrick Henry of kickedinthenuts.com. Yeah, that's you know where that's going. All right, so here, we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. Here's your short-order news for today. Pregnant pop princess Britney Spears is bearing nearly all on the cover of Harper's Bazaar magazine. The singer of Baby One More Time posed in the buff for the cover of the August issue. There's also a photo spread inside, and she's pregnant, folks. Pregnant. According to witnesses, Spears was recently seen driving with her unborn baby on her lap. The photo is reminiscent of Demi Moore's now legendary Vanity Fair cover, which catapulted her into years of semi-retirement. Woo! The Supreme Court largely upheld Texas' disputed congressional map in a symbolic boost for Republicans. At the same time, the court found that one of the new districts created under the map violates the Voting Rights Act by removing 100,000 Latinos from one district and placing them in a Home Depot parking lot.
Convenient.
The mayor of Berkeley, California, wants his city's voters to decide on whether or not to impeach President Bush and Vice President Cheney. If the impeachment resolution is approved by the city attorney, it will appear on the November ballot. Political observers say this vote by the city of Berkeley may just be the straw that has no... Dang it!
I screwed it up. Do it over.
All right. If the impeachment resolution is approved by the city attorney, it will appear on the November ballot. Political observers say this vote by the city of Berkeley may just be the straw that has no effect on anything. It's such a great joke. I was looking forward to doing it, and I screwed it up. But I think because I didn't tip it, I think it worked well the second time as well. Tomorrow, I will know things that have an impact on the future of this show.
Hey, you'll know things tonight. Give me a call before you go to the Friars.
Okay, I'll call you and I'll call Bill and let you know what the options are. And then I'll let the audience know tomorrow. Good night, sheeple. Please, please, be nice to your cats. ¶¶